Hello, this is Monocle Reads and I'm Georgina Godwin, and today I'm speaking to Jonathan Haywood, who is author of The Press Freedom Myth. In this fast-moving and century-spanning narrative, he brings us from the birth of the printing press to the rise of social media and confronts the problems associated with modern media, asking many questions along the way. And I'm so pleased that he's in the studio for us to ask those same questions. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you, Georgina. It's really great to be here.
Now, the press freedom myth is from Biteback Publishing, and it's actually part of a relatively new series. Tell us about that.
The series is called Provocations. It's edited by Yasmin Alibi Brown, who I'm sure many listeners will know is a columnist and writer herself. And I think the idea is that it's a series of fairly short, polemical books. They're all about 20,000 words long, so they can be, you know, people I think have told me they've read my book in a sitting. The idea is that you take a perspective that perhaps is a bit challenging and you set out to argue your case, even if you ruffle a few feathers along the way.
Mm. Well, you're perfectly placed to talk about press freedom because of your background. I mean, you've been a journalist and you've worked in human rights. Just give us an overview of what you've done.
Yeah, so I became a journalist way back in 2001. In fact, I remember applying for the job I then got at The Observer, and I went in to hand deliver my application letter. Took this really seriously, really wanted this job, wanted to make sure the application got to the right place. So I went into the offices in London and all the journalists were kind of running in and out of the lifts saying, oh, a plane's just flown into the World Trade Center. And obviously we know what day that was. And for me, that was a kind of sense of, wow, if a plane is going to fly into the World Trade Center, where would you rather be than in a newsroom where you've got a bunch of really smart, well-informed people trying to make sense in real time of what's going on in the world. So for me, that was a kind of really heady period of getting into journalism. I was at the soft end of things. I was on the books desk, so I was doing the author interviews and reviews and features and so on. But, you know, but in a place where people were constantly debating, what did September the 11th mean? What should Britain do in response? Should Britain support the American adventure in Iraq? The Observer took a really surprising contrarian position on that as quite a liberal newspaper, which way back in the 50s had actually come out against the government, the British government, when it went to war over the Suez Canal. The Observer took the opposite position in 2001, 2003 and actually supported the government in going to war in Iraq. And that was the subject of endless debate and argument in the newsroom. So it was a kind of heady, exciting time. I was fairly young. I just thought this was amazing. You know, I was living, sort of living the dream, really. Mm. And I became really passionate about journalism. I think partly because it is really fun. You know, those of us who've worked in journalism, you can be very high-minded about it, but you've got to admit it's quite exciting. You get to meet amazing people. You get access to kind of knowledge and secrets that aren't necessarily in the public domain. You get amazing gossip. It's fast moving. There are deadlines. I loved that. I'd been doing a PhD before that. I'd thought I was going to pursue an academic career. So I'd spent the previous 3 or 4 years in the rare books room at Cambridge University Library working to this 4-year deadline. And suddenly I was working
on which subject?
Oh, on 17th century drama, which we might come back to in a minute, because it was partly that stimulated some of my interest in the early days of printing. But I wanted to get out of that. I wanted to sort of be doing something that was right here, right now. So journalism was great. And I also began to think, and it's important, I began to think, you know, you really need journalism. And I became aware of the plight of journalists in countries like Turkey or Iran or Zimbabwe, and particularly at that period in Russia and Mexico, where journalists were and still are being killed for their work. So I went on from The Observer to a fantastic job with Penn. So Penn is the worldwide association founded in 1921, but now
the world's oldest human rights organisation.
Well, we like to say that. Yeah, I'm not quite sure if anyone's ever really sort of put that assertion to the test.
But full disclosure here, I should say that I'm on the Penn board, the English Penn board.
Quite. So I was director of English Penn from something like 2005 to 2012, I think. So in that time, I was busy as you are now, Georgina, really trying to sort of stand up and put our heads above the parapet. If we saw a colleague in a country where the press was less than free, you saw a journalist or an editor being harassed, persecuted, or at worst imprisoned, tortured, or even killed as a result of what they'd done in the honest pursuit of their job. So I was absolutely focused on that. I was absolutely sympathetic to anyone who found themselves, and I still am, anyone who finds themselves in that position of the worst, most brutal kind of censorship. But I think it led me to take a pretty sort of absolutist position. I really felt journalists are always the good guys, and anyone who is saying, you can't write that, you can't say that, must be the bad guys. Now, a lot of the time, that's true. But I think what happened to me over the course of that period was I was sort of increasingly having to deal with the times when it's not true, when perhaps the journalist is not the good guy, the editor, the newspaper owner, the broadcaster, perhaps they're not actually trying to advance truth or democracy or individual freedom. Perhaps they're actually on the side of intrusion, surveillance, repression, moral orthodoxy. And I began to experience a kind of cognitive dissonance, I think, where I was holding these incompatible ideas in my head at the same time. So to bring that to life, what was happening around 2008, 9, 10 was that whilst we were busy at Penn campaigning for press freedom around the world and in the UK, and often finding ourselves defending tabloid newspapers against attacks on them, at the same time, people were starting to talk about some of what's called the dark arts that were going on at those tabloid newspapers, that they weren't simply holding the powerful to account in the way that we like to sort of believe and that they like to tell us they were doing. They were, among other things, routinely listening in to the voicemail messages of ordinary people, people who might just completely inadvertently find themselves caught up in some big event in the news. And that came to a head when it was revealed in 2011 that journalists at the News of the World had been listening to the voicemail messages of a girl called Millie Dowler. And listeners in Britain will remember Millie Dowler was a girl who had disappeared from her home. There was a period of several weeks when no one knew what had happened to her. Later it transpired that tragically she'd been killed. But in that period of a few weeks when people were looking for her, the News of the World took it upon themselves to hack into her voicemail on her mobile phone, listen to the messages. They got the wrong end of the stick from one of the messages and decided that actually she was alive and had moved to the Midlands under a false identity. This is a 14-year-old girl, and ran stories to that effect, which caused the family incredible confusion and distress. As it happens, the family were also listening in to the voicemail messages to find out where their daughter might be. And when they saw those messages showing up as having been listened to by someone else, they assumed it was Millie. So they assumed a week or two after her disappearance that she must be alive. So the Leveson Inquiry was called to look at this issue. And I remember going along to the Leveson Inquiry, I was there as a press freedom advocate to say, look, no matter what's happened, freedom of the press is sacrosanct. You can't do anything to regulate the press. It'd be the end of civilization. And I walked into the inquiry and saw across the hall this small, scared-looking woman, and I realised it was Millie Dowler's mother. I felt such sort of human compassion for her. And at that moment, I guess I kind of began to think, how can I go on just treating people like this as collateral damage? You know, it just did not seem morally right to me to say that this good thing called press freedom must be somehow at the expense of these ordinary people. I suppose that was the moment where my thinking began to really change.
And that is what led to you founding Impress. Tell us about that.
So Impress came out of that process. So I, like I say, went into the Leveson Inquiry. The Leveson Inquiry was asked by the government to look at all of this evidence that was now coming to light about phone hacking, but it also looked at all sorts of other things, discrimination in the press, the way that certain groups, Muslims, asylum seekers, travellers, Roma, LGBT, all sorts of groups suffering constant drip, drip, drip feed of distorted or negative or simply inaccurate coverage. It looked at the way that women are represented in the press. It really heard evidence from all sorts of people. And it was, for any of us that are really interested in journalism and how it works in society, it was really amazing. For a year, you could sit and watch on your laptop, live streaming, Rupert Murdoch, Paul Dacre, Alan Rusbridger from The Guardian. You know, there's some of the most senior figures in the British media hauled into the light of day and put on the witness box and asked questions and obliged to answer them under oath. And it was, you know, a kind of masterclass in the state of the industry. And I think for me, again, watching that, I just kept thinking, I don't know about this. You know, there was something felt wrong. Something felt, I felt like I'd been taken for a ride, I guess, that I had been there through what I thought were good motivations, trying to defend the rights of these newspapers to pretty much do what they liked, because I thought that there was a moral compass, I think, underpinning a lot of what they were doing. And the evidence became very clear that there wasn't. Then there was this notorious moment when Richard Desmond, who at that time was the owner of the Express and Star newspapers, someone who had made part of his fortune, at least, publishing magazines like Asian Babes, was asked by the Leveson inquiry, by the counsel to the inquiry, what did he think about ethics? And he said, ethics? You know what? I've never really known what that word means. And it just seemed the utter contempt with which he could talk about ethics. He might think it's a highfalutin word, but I think we all know it's about how you treat other people and whether you do that with respect or not. I couldn't tolerate that any longer. So I began to think, well, what does it take? I'm not saying that I think journalists should be locked up and tortured, you know, any more than I had been the day before, but I didn't think it was acceptable that in order for the newspapers to be free to hold the government and powerful people to account, that should mean that they should be absolutely free to do what the hell they liked to anyone they liked with no comeback. That doesn't seem morally acceptable or necessary. So Leveson recommended a new kind of regulation. He said, OK, you don't want the state telling journalists what to do. He accepted that argument. But he said, nor do you want newspapers to be a law unto themselves, which they had kind of more or less been under the previous self-regulator, the Press Complaints Commission. He said, what you need is self-regulation. So it's not the state, it's not government, it's not politicians running the regulator. But the self-regulator itself needs to be audited just to make sure it's really doing what it says on the tin. So if it says it's a regulator and it's going to uphold standards and stop people hacking phones and publishing discriminatory reporting and getting their facts wrong, that if that's what the regulator says it's doing, then it needs to be audited to prove that's what it's doing and that it can't go native. In the same way that the press would be, you know, go apoplectic if in any other industry, imagine supermarkets or oil or banking or pharmaceuticals, if you had a big, powerful industry marking its own homework without any kind of public oversight, the press would be first to say that's unacceptable. So that's what Leveson concluded. The big beasts of Fleet Street, the publishers of The Mail, The Sun and so on, said, no, not doing that. Death of press freedom. We're going to continue doing pretty much what we were doing before. And having gone through this kind of conversion process, I guess, over the previous year, I just found that unacceptable and began talking to people and saying, isn't there some way that, you know, couldn't someone set up a regulator that did meet those Leveson conditions, that did uphold decent standards, would still be independent of the state, but would also be independent of the industry? And people said, well, I guess it could be done. I mean, Leveson said he set out a basic set of recommendations for what that regulator should look like, how it should be constituted, what powers it should have. And I talked to The Guardian and they were kind of saying, yeah, we think things need to change. Maybe someone should do this. I kept sort of saying, well, who's doing it? Everyone was quite keen on the idea, but no one was doing it. So eventually I was kind of suddenly realised I was doing it. And out of these conversations, Impress was born.
And in fact, the book is really your manifesto in a way.
In a way, yeah. I mean, what I've tried to do is to go back into, like you said, the history of press freedom. So I suppose I felt what happened to me having set up Impress back in 2013 and then begun to pull together a whole range of interesting publishers who wanted to be part of that and wanted to be held to higher standards, not Fleet Street, not the old newspaper companies, but lots of much newer media organisations like Bellingcat, fantastic investigative non-profit that does reporting on what's happening in Syria and Ukraine, the first people to reveal the identity of the Skripal poisoners in Salisbury, organisations all across the country doing sort of local journalism for audiences in new ways. So we began to pull together this coalition of the willing. We can't impose ourselves on anyone. But nonetheless, my old friends in the kind of press freedom world and the journalism world were pretty sceptical. You know, someone said, Jonathan, I thought you were one of us, as if I'd sort of gone to the dark side. And I had sleepless nights. Have I gone to the dark side? Have I got this really badly wrong? is it an either or? You know, is it either press freedom, warts and all, or is there this more nuanced position that I thought was possible? So I guess it's, you're right, it's partly a manifesto, but it's also genuine soul searching in the book. I'm genuinely trying to sort of answer to my own satisfaction, is press freedom a black and white, either or, on or off, yes or no, or is it a bit more complex than that? And luckily for me, I do come to the conclusion that it's a bit more complex than that.
When you go back to 17th century printing, was there always truth in media, or was fake news always around?
Always around. Very, 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 very from the start. I mean, if you look at the history of newspapers, newspapers don't suddenly come out of nowhere with someone saying, hey, let's invent journalism and let's set out all these sort of standards that shall constitute journalism, and journalists shall fact check and double source and put serious allegations to the subject of those. You know, none of that. That all came way later. Journalism, as we now know it, came out of pamphlets and broadsheets and diatribes, some of which purported to publish prophecies about the future. So you have all sorts of 16th, 30th, 17th century pamphlets, you know, amazing prophecies from old Mother Shipton, you know, two-headed calf is born in Harrogate. This means that next year the Queen shall give birth to a monstrosity, and this means that Catholics are taking over the country. And so fake news comes before real news. Real news is slowly, slowly born as people begin to realise, OK, this new culture that print is allowing, where you can get information quite quickly spread around the country, and even illiterate people can access that because someone can read it to them, that does provide an opportunity for people to be informed. But it takes a long time for people to work out that there are rules of the game. So in the book, what I'm really saying is, I think ultimately what I believe in is not press freedom as in the freedom to print anything, and there's reasons that we can talk about in relation to social media where I think that's made it even clearer how problematic that can be, that total freedom. But what I strongly believe in is the freedom of journalism. But journalism is a game played according to rules. And if you say something is journalism, it means that you have double-sourced, you have fact-checked, you have put allegations to the subject before publishing, and so on. It's not, someone once pointed this out to me, journalism is not the same as free speech. Journalism is actually quite a professionally modified kind of speech, kind of expression. And that's what gives it value. And that's why we should trust good journalism.
So I guess that the real question is, how can we maintain a freedom of the press whilst policing it?
I think, firstly, by accepting that, like I say, it's a game played according to rules, just like democracy more broadly. So we all believe in democracy, but we don't think democracy means that whoever wants to make themselves prime minister walks into number 10. We understand that democracy means that there shall be free and fair elections. That means that there must be people who oversee those elections independently. It means that we go and cast our votes anonymously in a ballot box, that the ballots will be properly counted, that the count will be independently overseen. That, very importantly, in an election campaign, there are some standards of transparency about, you know, who's funding which party, who's responsible. You know, lots and lots of rules of democracy. And otherwise, it's not democracy. So in the same way for me with press freedom, the important thing is that you have journalism that informs people, that does it in a kind of relatively responsible way. There must be freedom for that. But that doesn't come from an absolute free-for-all sort of state of nature. If you leave it to the market will gravitate towards information and material that satisfies people's most immediate basic needs, wants, but may not be, in fact, is quite unlikely to be what society as a whole needs and wants. So I come to this view that actually what you do need is for journalists to take seriously that idea of responsibility, and ideally to form independent, self-regulatory press councils that will seriously uphold standards. But if they can't or won't do that, as we saw in the UK, then I think there's a limited role for the state to come in, as Leveson recommended, and just do a basic health check on the press council, not get directly involved in the business of journalism, but at least ensure that there's a kind of independent framework for ensuring that something that says it's journalism is journalism.
Jonathan, there are so many places we could go with this, and unfortunately we're out of time, but people can unpack it much more by reading the book, which is called The Press Freedom Myth, and it's part of Biteback's Provocation series. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the production team of Louis Allen and Charlie German. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.